I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 70 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. And Janet and Gerardo from San Jose wrote to me and said, "Hi, David, just to let you know that we listen on internet, PRN.FM, and on the telephone every Tuesday. Thanks for the show." So I sent Janet and Gerardo two of my bookmarks. These little bookmarks are made with my own photographs. And I think anybody who actually still reads a real book will enjoy them. And if you don't read books, you have an iPad or something, then you can always put them on the shelf as a little photographic decoration. I would just like to say how much I appreciate everybody who does listen to the show, all the comments that I get from people. The listenership to the show is increasing. I'd also like to thank PRN.FM for making this possible, and I would encourage you to go to the PRN website and become a sponsor of the network, because without the network, this show would not be possible. Anyway, now I would like to get to my guest, John Dow. Today I'm interviewing John Dow, who was a Canadian soldier in Somalia in 1993 when the so-called Somalia Affair happened. He believes that the malaria drug mefloquine, see episode 67 with Remington Nevin, played a role. John was born in Germany and lived there 8 years because his father was in the military. After graduating from high school, he boxed from 1985 until he joined the military in 1990. He entered the Canadian Airborne Regiment in 1991 and was in the first group sent to Somalia in December 1992, where he stayed until the end of the tour, June 1993. He stayed in the military until 2000, when he says he was misdiagnosed with a chronic disease and released. Late in 2014, he got in touch with a man who was involved in the Somalia Affair and discovered that the mefloquine controversy was still ongoing, and he started to fight to have the drug removed from the military, as well as other settings, I presume. I'll get to John in just a second, but first a little background on the Somalia Affair. It happened a long time ago. Most Canadians have probably forgotten, and it wasn't a big deal outside of Canada. So this information comes from Wikipedia, and I'll get John to comment on it afterwards because he was there. The affair started when several soldiers of the elite Canadian Airborne Regiment decided that they were going to stop local Somalis from sneaking onto the base and stealing stuff by setting up a watch post with a searchlight so that they could deal retribution, and they did. Two boys snuck in. Ahmed Arush was literally blown apart, and Abdi Hunde bin Sabri was severely injured. In another incident, soldiers captured Shidane Abukar Aroni on an abandoned American base. Believing he was going to sneak into the Canadian base to also steal supplies, they captured him. He was beaten more and more severely and eventually died. At least 15, and possibly as many as 80 other soldiers, heard or saw the beating but did not intervene. There was a cover-up followed by an inquiry which revealed racism within the regiment, including the use of the Confederate flag against the orders of superior officers. In one case of hazing, a black soldier was led around on a leash with "I love KKK" written on his back. The public inquiry was initiated after 16 photos of the torture session were released in late 1994. The scandal was worsened when the Defense Department was caught releasing altered documents to a reporter. The inquiry resulted in several soldiers being convicted of murder, torture, or lesser offenses, although none of the convicted served more than 1 year in jail. One soldier attempted suicide and became severely brain damaged. The Defense Chief of Staff, John de Châtelaine, resigned, as well as his successor, Jean Boyle. The Minister of National Defense, David Colinet, also resigned. Perhaps the most significant action was the dissolution of the entire Canadian Airborne Regiment. Some people feel that the Somalia Affair was just an excuse, as the government wanted to cut the military budget anyway. The investigation consumed an enormous amount of time, and eventually it was terminated before reaching a final stage. This may have protected people higher up in the military hierarchy from criticism and possibly criminal charges. Our question today is whether the pharmaceutical mefloquine or other drugs could have caused or exacerbated the behavior of the soldiers who killed the Somalis and those who did nothing. So, John, you were there in 1993, so what part of it did you see, and then what happened afterwards?
Good morning, David. First off, this is my first podcast, my first time speaking out on the issue, so bear with me if I tend to go off at length. There's a lot to
say. Oh, no problem.
Okay. Well, what you just listed off, there are some accuracies, and there's a lot of inaccuracies in that Wikipedia post, which is quite unfortunate. I'm glad that you have me on here today to help clarify quite a bit of that, actually.
Yeah, okay.
So let's begin. Can you give me a quick question here and get you back on track?
There were two incidents, and you told me that you were in the bunker where the beating took place.
That's a great place to begin. We'll begin there. Shadane, the Somali that you mentioned, who had tried to break into our compound, had been doing so repetitively. It wasn't the first time. And we had this ongoing issue where they had the local populace kept trying to infiltrate the camp.
Right.
So finally, we had been giving in an orders group orders that we will then rough up the prisoners to give them a stronger message about not doing so.
And right.
When we would capture them and bring them down to the police station we set up, they would invariably be released. So as a deterrent, finally the orders had come down, rough up the prisoners, and so that's what had happened with Shadane. He was captured again. He was a repeat offender in this. He'd been caught before. And we were given the mefloquine. So you take this unlawful order, which enabled the action, and the mefloquine, which impaired the mental state of the soldiers as well. You have a perfect cocktail for disaster.
Right. Well, let's talk about the mefloquine. One of the reasons why the military might like it is I believe that it's given once a week, so it's a lot easier to administer than a daily drug. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It was cheaper, and also as far as supply chain management goes, the issuance of one drug a week is ideal, especially in these far-out locales where we were situated.
Right, right.
As opposed to having to put their soldiers on a daily regimen of a dose of malaria pills. It just wasn't feasible.
Okay, so when this beating took place, how did that relate to the weekly dose of mefloquine? Was it that day, the day before?
I believe it was on the Wednesday, so we were either given the drugs on the Tuesday afternoon and the evening, or maybe on that Wednesday. So yes, it had occurred within 48 hours of another dose.
Okay.
Within 24 to 48 hours, yes.
Right.
And you have alcohol as well. So add that with the extremes of the heat and the environment that we were in, the unlawful order, you get that.
So what was the unlawful order?
It was to rough up the prisoners. It was to send the message that, okay, if we capture you and we bring you downtown to the police station that we helped set up and detain you and off you go again and you come right back, we have to take further action. And I guess that was in the head. Completely ridiculous order that was given down in the orders group officially. Rough them up then. Let them know we mean business.
Right, so this was not the first time that a prisoner had been roughed up, but this was the first time it ended with the prisoner dying?
To my knowledge, yes, absolutely. It's the only one I'm aware of.
Right, but other prisoners had been roughed up, beaten before being released?
Prisoners are by and large going to get roughed up during the point of capture. It depends on what sort of action took place to capture them, right?
Right, right.
What state they're in, but when you put them within your custody, their health and welfare is now in your hands. And
right.
To give us an order like that, and we were already affected by the mefloquine. We've been given it for quite some time. Quite a few soldiers were already complaining about adverse effects. The withdrawal symptoms had already begun. They were underway. A lot of soldiers were dissociated, hyper-aggressive, nightmares, sleepwalking.
Right.
It ran the gamut. And so by March, plus more and more hostilities were intensifying in the area. So if you get into the what had been going on the ground, there was a lot more hostilities and anger. And
right.
you know, so things were coming to a head.
Right. Well, Canada was supposedly there doing peacekeeping, but it sounded like the locals weren't.
Well, no, that's wrong. We were there on a peacemaking, a peace enforcement action.
Okay.
The chapter, the actual mandate was had been changed so that we would have much stronger rules of engagement.
Right.
Because we were there to provide, to make the peace, because the whole area was unstable.
Right.
So let's get that up there, too. We were under a different mandate. We weren't UN.
Okay. Now, what do you believe these... I mean, were the people who were sneaking onto the base, were they mainly adults or kids or...
Well, Shadane was as tall as me. He was 17 years old, but he was my friend, right? Like, he wasn't some little fella, but he was someone who would repeatedly try to get into the camp. I think someone, one of the other soldiers you mentioned, he'd seen his face at least 6 or 7 times before.
Right, and were they, was it like petty theft? So they just...
Well, no, they were going after anything they could. Our weaponry, whatever they could get after. Plus, there were incidents where there was sabotage over, like I mentioned earlier, at the helicopter pad. So they weren't just after water, and these were people that were healthy.
Right.
They were not just someone trying to get in to grab a box of rations.
Well, I guess in a place like Somalia, an automatic weapon is, even if you don't intend to use it yourself, it's worth a lot of money in civilian hands.
And not only that, the camp itself, I mean, we had concertina wire, we had trip wire, we had signs up, we had lights, roving patrols. I mean, you know, the signs in their language is we've been there for months and months. They knew we were there. They knew not to be there. And it's repeated infiltration of the camp. That is what provoked that resistance order from our ROC, our officer in command major. He was to give us that rough up the prisoner's order, which is
wrong,
and it set off these chain of events.
Right. So was the man who gave the order Master Corporal Clayton Matchie? Or was it higher than that?
Oh, no, the orders were much higher than that. It was given in an official orders group where the troops sit down and direct orders are passed on to your officer in command. Then it was, you will rough up the prisoners.
So at what level do you think it came from, then?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I'm sure it went higher than that. I didn't check. I just know as my section commander sat me down with the rest of my section and gave it and said, this is coming up from on higher, I did kind of figure out or found out it did come from Major Seward. And he was actually reprimanded for that order, but I don't know if it came even higher from him. It must have. I don't know.
Right.
I don't want to speculate. You know, there's already so much speculation. I really just want to get to the facts of what I know.
Right. But you're correct. I mean, Wikipedia says that Major Anthony Seward was convicted of unlawfully causing bodily harm and negligent performance of duties, and he's the highest level person who was convicted of anything?
Wow, I guess so. Wow.
Yeah, which is not that high, right? A major
not at all.
Super high. I mean, you can conceive of him going to the guy above him and saying, what are we going to do about all this theft and sabotage and infiltration, and somebody told him to do something. I mean, it may not have originated in his head, but we don't know that.
To be fair to that major, he wasn't the ideal fit for the operation to begin with. He was a late slot. He was slotted in late just prior to the tour. He didn't command much respect from the troops, and his performance was subpar. I'm just going to state that straight out.
Right.
With as much respect as I can.
Yeah.
He wasn't a good fit on anything. So.
Right.
And if he was a good fit, he would have been lead or attempted to stop that order right from his level on down.
Right. So the two people who were most involved with the actual beating were Master Corporal Clayton Matchie and Trooper Kyle Brown. And did you see anything unusual in their behavior? I mean, did you see any of the beating? Like, what were your observations?
We were all well aware of each other, that we were off, that we were slightly askew mentally, that we were not of our own nature. We were aware of that. We knew that. For those who had, gone to speak to their medics and such and said, look, I think it's the drug. I'm all wacky on the drug. They'd say, no, drink more water. Stay out of the sun. There's a lot of stressors here, there's no other thing they could do. Even though we know now that we have a ship's dispatch as early as December 1992 of soldiers reporting symptoms temporarily associated with the drug. So that was being sent from the ship off to Ottawa. Interesting. So
from a ship? There was a ship in tropical waters?
Yes, there was the Preserver. The Preserver was our Canadian, a part of our battle group that was our Navy asset. And they would bring troops back and forth, supplies. There was a medical station on board.
Right.
So that we have that dispatch where they were saying we're getting reports of adverse effects from the drug. Nothing ever happened. So we were all like, okay, I guess we got to take this thing then. Bash on troops, get the job done.
Was there anybody who didn't take it? Like, did you take it under supervision, or were you sort of given the pill and told to go away?
Once a week or so, we were given, we were dispensed the drug. A medic would come over. He would have the group or the lock for the troops, and it would be dispensed once. Although some troops, I believe, were given some in advance in a bottle,
right.
A round bottle with this, like, red sort of tape on it saying experimental or whatever the hell. So it was an unlicensed drug, right? So even the packaging was not what you would see today. We had no product insert. There was no informed consent. It was so some had, a few of them on them, but more than typically, it would be a medic come along, dispense. Anyway, let's get back to where I was.
So you observed.
We knew that we were being affected.
Right.
On that day, what I had seen in the bunker was just beyond pale. It was now full on psychosis. I had happened by the bunker because I was making a phone call, and I have to pass by the bunker if you leave the compound.
Right.
On my return from the phone call, Clayton Matchie calls me over. He sees me. Hey, Dow, get over here. Come over here. I'm just a trooper myself.
Right.
Lowest rank. I happen by the bunker. I look inside the bunker. Clayton Matchie has a baton in his hand, and he lifts up the head of Shadane Aroney, where I see the bruised and bloodied face.
Right.
So I look at that. I'm like, ooh, this guy's in rough shape. Then Clayton Matchie stands back, and he begins to strike the prisoner, but he strikes him once in the torso. But then I take a look at him, like, well, what's this for? Are you giving me a display here? I don't need to see a display. What's this about? I look, I see Kyle there. I see this can of beer over at the edge of the bunker. Matchie, I look at Matchie. He's not himself. After the shot on the torso, he starts moving backwards, and he starts to hit the legs and then moves back and starts smacking the ground, and he starts swearing. And I look down at the ground. Why is he smacking the ground? And then he starts to smack, turns, and starts to smack the side of the bunker. It's the camel spiders. We were inundated with camel spiders. They were everywhere.
Okay.
And he was smacking the baton, the camel spiders that weren't there.
Right.
He became distracted. I look up at Kyle. I give Kyle the look that, a man who sees something that isn't right looks at another man and says, hello.
Right.
This breaks Kyle's spell somewhat. He looks at me. I gather his eye contact. I then look at Clayton again, still busy smacking at spiders that aren't there. I turn around. I go out the bunker. That's my cue to get the hell out of there.
Right.
As I start walking off, I hear Kyle coming up running behind me. John, John. He stops me. I stop and I look at him. He goes, listen, this isn't in my nature. And I look at him and said, he's a master corporal. We have orders. You're a trooper. What are we going to do? And I wandered off, and I wandered back to my bunk, and I put on my headphones and listened to the same album I always listen to, which is about 58 minutes in length. Kyle wandered off wherever he wandered off to. When that album was over, I took the headphones off and I walked back to the headquarters building, the bomb of smoke, the headquarters tent. And I spoke to Brady McDonald, who was on shift, and he looked over and says, look at that. You could see from the open end of the modular tent there, there were soldiers over by the bunker and they were doing something. So I wandered over and there was a couple of troops there and they were pouring water and trying to revive the Shadane. But Shadane had already passed. He was dead.
So you didn't do anything. What would have happened if you told Clayton Matchie to stop?
Well, he would have told me, get the hell out of here. I'll deal with you later. I'm a master corporal. We have orders. What the hell are you talking about? Well, I'll deal with you later. Get the hell out of here or something. I would have been summarily dismissed. And then I would have paid for that later.
Right, right. And if you had actually stopped him from beating Shadane, and so Shadane hadn't died and there hadn't been a scandal, I guess you would have been punished, and then everybody would have said, well, why? It's easy to quarterback afterwards. I've never been in the military, but it is a very hierarchical organization.
Orders are to be followed, and at that time, with given the environment we were in, the situations that were occurring, the infiltrations, given the fact that we were under a very extreme workload, heavy
right.
patrolling, heavy heat, on
right.
rations, we were getting one fresh meal a week. This
right.
has been going on for months.
Right, right.
We weren't even supposed to be there any longer. We had done our work. We had secured the area. Now it was time for UN to come in and get us the heck out of there.
Right.
We're a hyper-aggressive commando unit. We shouldn't have been there in the first place. After a month of securing it, we should have been gone. There should have been a rotation.
Uh-oh.
They kept us there.
Well, do you
so
think that
add
was...
Add in the alcohol, then add in the alcohol.
Right.
And then also add in now we're getting riots downtown. We're getting this. We're getting that. There's increasing hostility in the area.
Right.
Factor it all in. Gather the whole context. Now you throw in that methadone, which everybody knew.
Right.
Today, I have nothing but testimonials from soldiers that were in that unit, that were on that tour. Not just from the commando guys, but also from the whole battle. The Navy as well. They took the methadone. They saw strange occurrences happening in their group. I have a psychiatrist who took methadone in the CF, willing to testify at the Somali inquiry that him and his own mental health team were affected by the drug. And he's on our team today as we gather on all the
right.
Facebook groups from across the United States, Australia, UK, Ireland, everywhere.
Right.
And they're all providing a testimony today because we have the evidence, the scientific proof to back that we were affected, impaired by that drug, the toxicity of the method.
Right. You've identified a lot of factors that lead up, that may have led up to this tragic, brutal event. First of all, Canadian Airborne Regiment, as you said, it's a commando regiment, and so they're supposed to go in under the cover of night, do
yeah,
violence, and get out.
Force. They're not regular UN, typical UN deployed troops at all.
Right. The environmental conditions, the heat, the dust, the spiders, and stuff like that must get to
aspects.
People. Nutrition, the sort of boredom combined with stress because you never know
yeah.
when somebody's going to shoot at you or do something, and then all the infiltrations into the camp, plus methylquine and alcohol. That's a lot of factors.
Yeah. A heady cocktail, my friend.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's tragic, and the military hierarchy that. I mean, it's easy to say you should have said something, but as you said, that might not have changed anything except that you would have got disciplined.
Another soldier was asked the very question you asked many years ago, and he said, at that time, I ask myself that question every day. Why did
yes.
I stop?
Right, no. right.
Not Kyle, or obviously not Clayton, but yeah.
Yes, everybody who's walked past... an
it
event.
Would change our nature to act in accordance with the way we should.
Yes, yes. It's easy to quarterback afterwards. I mean, you walk past the fight on the street, and if you found out later one of the guys got killed, people might say, "Why didn't you do anything?"
It's the age-old question: if you were back in time and you could have taken Hitler out, would you take a shot?
Yes. What did you know about the shooting of the two Somalis, one of which was severely injured, like literally almost blown apart? There was some report about the soldiers.
I don't know a whole lot about that. I do know the man who took the shot. I'm up with him on Facebook. We're still friends. He'd be the man that would actually should give the story.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that there was another Somali infiltrating the helicopter compound. We were concerned about the sabotage on that. There had been incidents in the past where things went missing or were damaged.
Mm-hmm.
So he was tasked to set up a position and to protect the outer compound, and he did so.
Yes, by killing an infiltrator and severely injuring another. But they actually set up, they waited for people to come in, right? And they even set up, according to Wikipedia, they set up some water and some bread somewhere.
Well, I know you're getting into the old aspect mm-hmm. of entrapment or bait.
Right.
But when you start to get into protocols and processes, how to actually carry out certain tasks, there are certain steps you take, there's certain things you have to do. When you're out on a snatch patrol or you're going to bring someone in, or if you want to capture someone, yes, of course, you're going to utilize different tactics.
Right. Well, I mean,
that wasn't like some form of, some cheese to a trap. I mean,
well, I guess it looked...
I don't want to be reductionist here.
Right, right. But I guess it looked like it, because that's where they shot him. If they had captured him at that point, then you could say, well, he was trying to steal something and they captured him.
Yeah.
Although arresting a guy because he's stealing water and bread doesn't maybe look so good when you get back into Canada.
Absolutely. But, and you know what? I'll tell you something else. No professional soldier wants to shoot someone because they were just trying to feed themselves.
Right.
Right. So obviously if someone's going to take a shot, something else is going down. I'm just speculating. Again, I don't want to, though.
Right.
He would be the best to give that story.
Right. Anyway, we should talk more about mefloquine. You mentioned that a psychologist had his group had taken it and they'd experienced side effects.
Yeah, the Canadian Forces psychiatrist and his medical team had been on tour in Rwanda and were given the mefloquine.
Mm-hmm.
He had noticed quite a few peculiar adverse effects happening within his team.
Right.
He notified me and let me know about this recently. He was also the only one that was willing and did provide a paper on the whole situation and was willing to testify at the Somalia inquiry, and it got shut down prematurely.
And he was going to testify about mefloquine?
Absolutely, to the deleterious effects of the drug on the personnel.
Were there any other drugs that were given that could have caused these side effects? I mean, how do you know it's mefloquine? Was that the only drug you were basically given weekly?
It's the only quinoline-based chemoprophylactic that has those sort of pharmacokinetic, characteristics that would give those symptoms, and it's so distressing because it also, the symptoms somewhat mimic PTSD, so you have a confounding effect.
Right.
So,
right.
You have to then filter it out and determine, is it PTSD, is it mefloquine toxicity, is it a mixture of both? There's several categories now that have to, criterion has to be established, and that we're in the process of doing.
Right. Well, I mean, it's true based on the interview with Remington Nevin, who seems to know an awful lot about mefloquine, that this psychotic behavior is definitely being linked in many occasions to the drug.
We're past wild speculation. We're now
right.
on to facts.
Right, right.
Yeah, when you're actually seeing, like, the lesions, the effects in the limbic system
right.
in the brain, now we're starting to have what we need to come forward.
Right. Now, you said you got in touch with Trooper Kyle Brown in late 2014, is that correct?
Yes.
And he was, just to remind people if they're getting names mixed up, he was the lower level soldier, the lowest level of soldier in the bunker with Master Corporal Clayton Matchie, who, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, Clayton Matchie attempted to commit suicide and caused severe brain damage, and eventually the military dropped the charges they had against him because he was not fit to stand trial. But anyway, you reconnected with Trooper Kyle Brown, and why did that reignite your interest in mefloquine?
Well, it was the first I had spoken with Kyle in since the incident. I'd only seen his face at the trials, and I was just there to provide testimony for the prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
But we were separated, and I, like most soldiers, was completely turned off because of the opprobrium that faced the public shame when we came back to Canada. We left on tour in the dark, and we came back in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
So through all of this whole experience, everybody just turned their eyes and wandered off to the world and never looked back sort of thing. Most people.
Right.
I was one of them. I had gone off. I had lived abroad. I wasn't part of it. I wasn't part of the military community so much. And again, even while I was still in the service for another 7 years after Somalia, it was not a topic that was typically broached.
No, it's not.
So, and then again, you know, we knew we were all wonked out from the mefloquine, but there wasn't any sort of further evidence or research that we could cling on to discover what really went down. So in the fall of 2014, I had a conversation with my wife. She has a degree in psychology, and she'd known over the years that Somalia was unfinished business to me. And she said, well, maybe you should speak with Kyle, and that could be a part of the closure.
Right.
And I said, you know what? You're right. I should call Kyle. Now, Kyle had sent me a letter while he was in Edmonton and stuff, but I hadn't responded.
Right.
And I was of the sort of mindset that most were, that Kyle was guilty of something, and, you know, the regiment was disbanded for that, and so we shouldn't like Kyle. That's probably another reason why I didn't contact him.
Right.
Now we know today that nothing could be further from the truth.
Right.
So I tried to make the phone call. I link up with him on Facebook. And in linking up with Kyle, I also noticed that he's welcome back within the airborne community. And I thought, that's interesting. I thought he was shunned. I thought he was the black sheep. Why do they have Kyle open back up within the airborne community of the type brotherhood? So something's going on.
Right.
So I call Kyle. And bam, it's the first time I hear his voice in over 20 years.
Right.
And it all comes back. Everything to the detail of what I remembered, the whole situation, all of it. Because over the intervening years afterward, I also had some gaps in memory.
Mm-hmm.
So, because it was a traumatic event for me to see in the bunker that evening, of course.
Right, right.
But it all came, it was crystal clear. And I thought to myself after the conversation, there's a lot to the story here.
Right.
And Kyle also had mentioned mefloquine controversies. Yeah, there's still controversies about mefloquine. You should check that out.
Let me ask, is mefloquine still used by Canadian forces?
Yes.
And under, like, presumably, if you're based in Canada, you don't take mefloquine because it's not considered a risk for malaria. So what kinds of places in the world do Canadian soldiers take mefloquine?
Well, so let's get to that for a second. It's very strange because in areas like Iraq and other places where the malaria effect was very low, so, you know, some areas where there was really no risk or threat of malaria, mefloquine was still issued.
Just in case.
Just in case, I guess. Ridiculous. So, although today the line would be the same much as the line is out of Britain, where we consider it a drug now of last resort and we properly screen our soldiers and we only give it in certain cases and blah, blah, blah. Not true.
I was going to...
handing it out.
Yeah.
Groups are still uninformed. Properly not informed.
I tried to find out in the case of Jason Beale. He was the American soldier in Afghanistan who left the base one night and went and killed 16 civilians. And I tried to find out about mefloquine. Or maybe Remington Nevin told me this. I found out that the special forces in the United States, they still give it out, but they don't keep records of the drugs that they give to their soldiers.
That can occur. Yeah, that can occur where you'll have like medics way out in the field that are dispensing the drug kind of on their own, almost ad hoc.
Right.
And maybe not as a part of, you know, a standard or issued directive to do so. That can happen too, and has happened. Right.
Right, and so it's possible that
and
Beale...
also in the States now, if there has been the decree has been laid, there will be no more special forces troops getting mefloquine. Dr. Nevin has been successful in the United States.
Okay,
and now Veterans Affairs in the United States is recognizing the toxicity effects of the drug to the soldiers, assessing them, establishing criteria and compensation. It's all happening. That's not happening in Canada. Our Veterans Affairs refuses.
And do the side effects of mefloquine go away quickly with time? Like, you're given it once a week, so once you stop, you came back to Canada, you stopped taking it. Did you experience side effects after that time, or did it all go away once you stopped?
No, yeah, it depended on how the drug affected the soldier. For some soldiers, they were fine. I'm not trying to throw mefloquine as a whole under the bus here. I know it's very effective for malaria, but the problem was when you give it out en masse and don't inform the troops that these prodromal experiences that you're having, such as nightmares, etc., are signs that you should maybe quit the drug. They're not getting that sort of consent or that monitoring. So, you know, I'm not trying to say, oh, mefloquine, all bad, get rid of mefloquine. I'm trying to say, stop dispensing it without informed consent and monitor it more closely and only give it out as the ultimate last resort?
Well, actually, Remington Nevin said that it actually was not very effective against malaria when they actually finally tested it. But let's assume
he's the man. You know,
yeah, I guess he knows.
Honestly, he's the leading expert on it. And that's another issue where someone could be, taking the drug for, say, several weeks, a month or more, right? And then they end up in the malaria region. The drug hasn't taken full effect yet. You're not protected from malaria, but you're still experiencing prodromal symptoms.
Right.
Because of the long, the serum life of the drug, it can then build up and break the blood-brain barrier and then affect you neurologically. Mm-hmm. And those symptoms can have symptoms for years. Some troops had symptoms for years. Some went away after, several months. Some people are permanent. It's permanent impairment due to the central nervous system damage.
Like you say, if you have vivid dreams for years after you left the military, you might say, oh, that's just PTSD. I have bad dreams.
That's right. There's the confounding effect. Is it just the PTSD? Well, now we know, as Dr. Remington has clarified, even for travelers, non-governmental workers and stuff, aid workers overseas that are given the drug don't see or don't typically would have a traumatic incident that they could say, I have post-traumatic stress from, yet I still have these symptoms. So they know, what would mimic those symptoms? Did you take methadone? Yes, I did. Oh, what did you experience while on the drug? Oh, I had crazy dreams, or I sleptwalked, or I had rage, or homicidal, suicidal ideation. And they know, okay.
I was talking to a friend of yours, Bev, who's a civilian, who took mefloquine while she was traveling around the world with her husband quite a few years ago, and she described that she had vivid dreams, but some of the dreams she kind of implied were quite pleasant. But, I guess if you're a soldier and you're seeing bad things, you're likely to dream about those bad things, where if maybe you're a traveler having a good time, your dreams might be different, even though it's the same drug. Do you see that? Like, were you dreaming about military-related...
Well, as we accumulate images during our waking, our day, as we accumulate those images and then go to sleep at night, as they replay in the mind, depending on what those images are, good, bad, or how your emotional state is, whatever, what's happening in the subconscious, which is the greater engine working at that time in dream state. Yes, of course. I mean, if you're seeing trauma during your day, starvation, you're seeing, gangrenous children, you're seeing dying animals, and you're in a hostile environment, that all gets that big interplay in the mind during sleep and can really, really disturb you. Also, you're experiencing insomnia. So when you do sleep, when you do finally get to sleep, it's very interrupted. You're not in your proper REM states.
Right.
The next day, it's an accumulatory thing. It's day after day of that.
Right, and lack of sleep can itself cause hallucinations and all kinds of things. I mean, that's a sleep deprivation.
Dissociative states. Your nature. You see, your nature changes.
Right.
The very nature of the person will change. And now that's where we get back to Kyle. Wow, this isn't in my nature.
Yes, and so what does he say about the event now? Like, what did he say to you about how he
feels
about it?
Well, that was the thing. We all knew who Kyle was. Kyle was a very soft individual. He had grown up quiet. He was a career soldier. He didn't just land into the military. He wanted to join the military. It was a direction he'd been working on for years. Very soft-spoken, very artistic, very intellectual, not a racist bone in his body. And that's another thing on the Wikipedia, which is ridiculous, about racism. That flag was part of the hockey team. That flag was given by a unit in the States. It didn't. There were racial sort of racism tinged within the regiment, but no more or less than what would be reflected in society as a whole. There was no, group of guys screaming, yay, KKK. And the group that did that hazing video was one commando, not two commando. That was the French unit. They get to wear that one.
Right.
But let me end the racism aspect right away. All the guys I worked with, they didn't have a racist bone in their bodies, and there was black guys in our regiment.
Yes.
That really touches a bone whenever I hear that.
Right. Well, I've been around a lot of parts of Canada in my life, and I've heard a lot of casual racism. By that, I mean just like comments that come out, in the middle of in any kind of conversation that's not about anything to do with racism, and somebody will just tell a racist joke, or...
Yes, it still permeates our society.
Yes.
But no more or less the military than that society.
Right. So if you had put the microscope on a different regiment in the Canadian military, you probably would have also seen racist behavior. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you'll find racism seedy existence anywhere you look when you look close enough. You'll find it in any organization. There's always a couple of individuals who are spreading hate. But I'm saying, by and large, with the 2 Commando or the Airborne as a whole, it wasn't a racist group. There might have been a couple of bad apples that were that way. They're everywhere.
Right.
Don't peg the regiment for that one.
Yeah. Well, I can see. I mean, the factors that you described before of being in a place where you didn't understand the culture, where people were hostile, where the environment was hostile, where you were bored, stressed. And then, as you say, add mephoquine and alcohol, and you've got a pretty toxic mix. Something bad's
going to happen. Clayton Matchie, the guy actually doing all the beating, Clayton Matchie was a tad. He was a womanizer. He was not a good man. Clayton Matchie himself, he wasn't a great guy.
Right.
So I'm not trying to say, oh, Clayton Matchie was good, but the drug changed his nature. Clayton gets to wear what happened there, right? But you also have to remember he was impaired by the damn drug and enabled by an unlawful order and was drinking.
Right.
So let's, and for Kyle, this was not in Kyle's nature.
Right. Right. But did he say how he feels about it now? Like, does he feel like he was in a different state back then? I mean, what does he say?
Oh, he knows he was, yeah. Kyle knows he was. And all the troops that, he speaks with, the group that he's with, they understand it now. After all the testimonials and over the years, that it's for the people that have been paying attention and understand exactly what went down, they know.
So you're saying that the other members of the Airborne Regiment allowed him back in to the group, stopped shunning him because they had experienced some of these side effects?
Yes, it was. Once we came back from Somalia, a lot of guys were dispersed through different units, right? And only through retirement and Facebook, thank you, Internet, they can finally start to get back together and reassociate.
Mm-hmm.
And as they've associated and shared stories, the common thread was always the same determination. Holy, we were really screwed up. A lot of us, not all of us, were quite screwed up from this drug. And Kyle, we know what you were like prior. We know what you're like now. And we know you were scapegoated. And we know the inquiry got shut down early. And we know. So that I missed that. See, I wasn't, again, I was one of those guys dispersed out throughout the world. I didn't come back to this situation for years.
Right.
So, now that you've got all these guys who are sharing their stories and finally coming forward, and it's very hard to get soldiers to talk, and getting them together in a group is like herding cats.
Right.
It's happening, and now we know what's going down, and we're working towards rectifying that. I had a long camera interview with Chris Sims in January.
Mm-hmm.
And Sun News Network gets shut down, and all of a sudden she becomes Director of Communications for Veterans Affairs, and my whole interview and our whole momentum over the previous months gets shunted. And we're sitting here scratching our heads wondering why.
Okay, well, let's go into that because the audience is mostly not Canadian. So Sun News Network was supposed to be, they called it Fox News North. It was supposed to be a right-wing news network. And one would anticipate that something like Fox News Canada would be pretty pro-military, and so they wouldn't want to go into something like the Somalia controversy, open up wounds. So why did somebody from Sun News want to talk to you about the Somalia affair, or about mephloquine, or both?
Both. The reason why is because I was the guy in the bunker who would witness this psychotic event. I'd watched Clayton Matchie. I looked in his eyes. I'd seen his face. This man was bonkers.
Right.
So I contacted Chris Sims from the advice of a good friend in the Airborne who had known her. He had known her work. She, in the past, had been trying to fight for the Airborne because she had family that were in the regiment in the past.
Right.
So she felt a familial connection, almost a family connection to the Airborne.
Right.
She was the Atlantic Bureau Chief for Sun News Network. She operated out of Halifax.
Right.
Now, I contact her after speaking with Kyle, after speaking to psychologists, after vetting my memories, after clarifying everything. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I'm good to go. I contact Chris Sims. She was someone who was always a champion of the airborne in the past. She says, John, this is great. I said, well, how did I do in the interview? Oh, you were clear, thoughtful, and eloquent. Hard to be all three on camera. This is great. Don't worry, I'm running with this one. Oh, my God. You know, this, with the replicant evidence we have today, we're set.
Right. And then what happened?
Then a few weeks later, Sun News Network shut down.
Right.
She becomes Director of Communications for Veterans Affairs. And we go nowhere.
Okay, so Veterans Affairs is the ministry in Canada that looks after veterans, a lot to do with veterans returning to Canada, mental
and
health
their,
issues.
And their health care. And
yeah,
their health care.
Health care.
This is the vital component here. The vital component is our Veterans Affairs would be the body to oversee, to reach out those veterans who took methadone in the past, assess them, and help them for benefits and treatment.
And what is Veterans Affairs?
Just like Veterans Affairs in the United States. Is
right.
But our Veterans Affairs, nothing. Crickets. That's all you hear.
So have people tried to get Veterans Affairs to help people dealing with the after effects of methadone? And they've done nothing.
Methadone was brought up at the shareholders meetings not too long ago. I was given that firsthand.
Shareholders.
By a member of a Veterans Emergency Transitional Services organization who said, yeah, someone brought that up in the shareholders meeting.
What shareholders meeting?
Well, you get these shareholders who deal with Veterans Affairs, the new Veterans Charter, all the administrative and compensation efforts that are being applied throughout veterans across Canada. You have these groups that work in the interest of these veterans, such as Emergency Transitional Services,
right.
Veterans Affairs themselves, and other subgroups who get together and you know, hash out how things are working, where do we go from here. It's somewhat like you would find in an organization for continuous improvement.
I think you mean...
It's continuous improvement, right?
I think you mean so. Stakeholders.
Oh, did I say shareholders?
Yeah, you said shareholders.
Yeah.
I was thinking you were talking about the drug company.
No.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
Okay, no problem. So I understand stakeholders. So
yeah.
So people who are involved with Veterans Affairs, involved with trying to help veterans with health issues, physical and psychological health issues after returning from being in the military. But they're not interested in dealing with methadone.
No, we're getting the standard reply, the same reply out of Britain, which is we only give out the drug at certain times to certain people, blah, blah, blah. But it's the same sort of staid sort of response that is really dismissive. It's not proactive, like the United States is. Chris Sims knew that my main goal here was to get our Veterans Affairs as involved and proactive as the United States. So she was aware of our purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the things that somebody who understands about methadone would be is, first of all, reevaluating whether it's actually effective, because, you know, Remington Nevins said it wasn't very effective with malaria. So
not as effective as one thought. Absolutely not
right,
as effective
right.
as one thought.
But, I mean, if it's not very effective, maybe it's not even needed as a drug of last resort. Like, why? They have daily dosing with another drug, doxycycline or something?
Well, there's doxycycline, there's Malarone. There's other ones today that people would be much more prescribing to this individuals, travelers, soldiers alike.
Right.
You know, something with a much lower side effect profile.
But they're daily drugs, right?
Yeah.
And
yes, but our supply chain has improved over the last 25 years as well. So
it shouldn't be a big deal.
Yeah, soldiers typically even carry more kit than they used to. A bottle of Malarone isn't going to weigh them down.
Right. With methadone, given that it created vivid dreams, and this civilian I talked to said that they weren't for her, weren't necessarily unpleasant. Do you think that there were soldiers who would overdose on methadone, who would actually like the vivid dreams and would try to get...
Wow, that's a good one. That thought never occurred to me. I can't see it. I can't see any soldier really liking it and then smashing up the pill and snorting it up his nose. Like, come on, I really don't think so.
Okay.
I think that's a little far out.
Well, people are funny with drugs, right? Like people.
Oh, I know. I mean, look what's happening with fentanyl today.
I mean, I don't do drugs beyond alcohol and coffee, but I am hoping to interview a guy who was a severe drug addict. He's now a neurologist, who's just written a book on drug addiction. But what he describes about his behavior is completely irrational. And at you know, when he was in the depths of his addiction, he would have done anything to get more drugs. And I think drug addicts also try a lot of different things. If they want to get a high, they'll take anything and give it a shot.
I agree. People will find the strangest sources for their addictions. I mean, even alcoholics with shoe polish or what have you, or I don't know, Listerine or whatever the heck they do. I get you.
Right. And is there any evidence that alcohol and methylquin have effects, synergistic effects that
Oh, yeah, because it's well known to avoid alcohol. It's very well known. Do not take alcohol with this drug.
And yeah. I think today aren't Canadian soldiers in many places forbidden to use alcohol while they're on duty?
Well, listen, I would certainly hope so. I mean, we know in the military there is a history of having a rum ration or some
right.
form of drink at certain periods to boost morale, you know, bring up the esprit de corps of the unit,
right.
have some bonding time and a little decompression.
Right.
However, yes, in the past that was abused. And when I know in our situation in the commandos, although we were heavily patrolling, we were always busy, there was still, you know, sometimes a 12-hour downtime. And having a few extra cold ones when you weren't on duty sure was a treat.
Right.
I would definitely now, at any forward operating position, I would never have alcohol.
Right. But was it pretty much uncontrolled?
Well, I wouldn't say it was uncontrolled, but the taps were certainly running.
Right. So if you had 12 hours off and you wanted to get hammered, it was not going to be that difficult.
Well, see, the situation, I think there was this notional restriction of no more than 4 beers per man per day or something like that.
Right.
Right, but, I mean, as with anything in life, things tend to get abused.
Right, and people figure out a way to stock up, or maybe...
That's only human behavior, right?
Yeah, if I knew a guy who didn't really like to drink, I'd say, well, get your 4 and I'll slip you up.
No, I'm going to have your 4, too.
Yeah, right. And now you're talking, I mean, 4 beers, most people aren't going to get hammered on that, but turn it to 8, and you're at a different ballpark.
And
you've got methylquin.
Your 30-second dose, you know, it's like, hello.
Yes.
Accumulation.
Okay, well, we're getting towards the end of the conversation. We just have a couple more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this group that you're with. Does it have a name? Does it have a website, Facebook page, anything like that?
You know
that?
What? We're still somewhat in our infancy. I've only started attacking this in the fall, November, December.
Right.
It's taken a few months along the way to kind of filter out who's going to work best with the group. There's about 5 or 6 core people in the group
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
We're linked up with Facebook groups from the United Kingdom, like I said, Australia, the States, all over. And people are, especially the Canadian military people, are coming to my Facebook. Just come to my Facebook page, John Dow. You'll find me there, and that's where everybody's getting all the information. I have running posts and updates about where we are and what we're up to.
Okay, so I'll put a link to your personal Facebook page, and if in the future you get...
That would be wonderful, Dave.
Yeah. Well, there's probably a lot of people listening to this who may have been in the military and taken this drug, or they know people who are currently in the military taking the drug, or they traveled and were given this drug for malaria. Do you know if it's still given to civilians for travel use?
I'm sorry?
Is it still given to civilians for travel use?
Yes. Oh, yes, it's still prescribed. Although, you know, thankfully from what I'm hearing, with a much greater degree of caution, and those people who are prescribed, those travelers, are typically winding up at clinics if they have an issue wherever they are, and they're being given something else. Unfortunately, that doesn't occur for soldiers. They're stuck
right.
with what they got.
Bev told me that she was told to start the methylquin like a month before she traveled,
mm-hmm.
but she was never really told what the side effects that she should look for were, and she didn't realize that the vivid dreams she was having were associated with the drug, whereas if the doctor had said, you know, one of the potential side effects is vivid dreams, and if you have them, you should take something else. She only discovered that later.
Right. That's all about the whole informed consent and the proper product label insert, which is detailing all the proper characteristics of the drug.
Right.
You know, same with us. So we're having all these weird dreams. Oh, we'll drink more water. Huh?
Yes.
You know, it's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I've experienced a quasi-hallucinatory state from dehydration, but I think drugs are a more potent way to get into that state. So is there anything else you want to add to this conversation before we wrap it up?
Well, I just, you know, for your listeners out there, I understand this is my first podcast, and if I tended to ramble somewhat, please forgive.
Yeah.
Come to the Facebook page where you'll get more ongoing information. And we're doing our best, although it's hard here in Canada with the election ongoing, to get the word out there, as it just seems to be more noise. Everybody's
right.
involved in getting elected. So
well,
just stay tuned to the Facebook page, and if you hear anything about it, feel free to pass on the links to me.
Yeah, well, definitely we'll stay in touch, and I will include a link to your Facebook page, and maybe we'll continue with this issue down the road, because I think a drug like this has potentially pretty toxic effects. I mean, it's hard to prove the mefloquine, you know, what role mefloquine played in the Somalia affair, but it's completely wrong to ignore the effect either, just as in the Jason Beal case. Jason Bates. If people are in an induced psychotic state, they're not necessarily responsible for their actions, and the institution that gives them the drug without telling them about the side effects has a pretty big responsibility.
Consideration must be made for this, yes.
Yes, yes.
And it's overdue.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, John. I really appreciate the time and the information that you've shared. It's not an easy issue to talk about, I know.
Thank you very much, David, for having me on the podcast. It was quite enjoyable.
Okay. Well, goodbye then. Well,
take care.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to episode 70 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.